This is the Breaker.News podcast for April 1st, 2018. Welcome. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this episode, regular features like the Is It Just Me commentary, Around the Rim, headlines from around the Pacific Rim, Cascadia Calling, headlines from around the Pacific Northwest, The Big Deal feature, Mr. EB Goes to Ottawa and Mr. Wiley Goes to Westminster, from money laundering at casinos to Facebook data mining, Victoria's secrets are revealed. And The Breaker will award a virtual Nanaimo bar to those that made a difference this week. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or should those members of the Metro Vancouver Board of Directors who voted themselves a pension not only cancel the plan, but quit public office immediately? On March 23rd, in a non-recorded show of hands, they voted for a retroactive pension at $1,100 a year if they're quitting politics or if they lose elections in their home municipalities this fall. Those that have been on the board since 2007 will be in line for a payday of more than $11,000. That's a down payment on a new SUV or a luxury cruise for two in the Mediterranean. All told, it'll cost $500,000 to start this scheme. Metro Vancouver controls a $761 million annual budget, which is spent on regional drinking water services, sewage plants, garbage dumps, social housing, and parks. The average household pays $473 in taxes, fees, and levies per year to keep Metro Vancouver in business. But we have no say at all in who represents us, because the board of Metro Vancouver is not directly elected. The directors are handpicked by their home council peers. One of the lone voices of reason was Burnaby City Councillor Colleen Jordan. She said, "Do we really think they need a 10% leaving allowance on top of their meeting stipend?" True enough, they already receive $387 for showing up at the four-hour board meetings. And if those meetings go beyond 4 hours, cha-ching, they get $775. Greg Moore is the Metro Vancouver chair. His nickname ought to be Pay Me, as in Greg, pay me more. A year after he was re-elected as Port Coquitlam's mayor, Greg Moore got a $1,000 raise to almost $93,000. As Metro Vancouver's chair, he pulled in another $74,000 last year. Vancouver City Councillor Raymond Louis is paid $85,000 a year at 12th and Cambie. Last year, he took in another $37,000 as Moore's vice chair. Moore will not run for re-election this October. Citizens of Metro Vancouver and City of Vancouver could only wish that Louis would quit as well. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the New Straits Times, Firuz Mohd Shahar reports Putrajaya to be cashless city by April next year. Putrajaya Corporation aims to make Malaysia's administrative capital a cashless city by April 2019. It would be realized through initiatives such as the implementation of Putrajaya Mobile and Putrajaya Cashless City Transaction Apps. Users just need to enter the payment amount based on information from the business or store and scan the QR code. Payments will be credited to the traders' and business owners' bank accounts on the following day. The project under the Smart Putrajaya program will benefit customers and traders as they will no longer need to carry big amounts of cash. The Putrajaya mobile app features various functions that will help visitors to explore Putrajaya and allows residents and visitors to access up-to-date information about the city. It also comes with a panic button function that allows users to contact police. In the South China Morning Post, Laura Zhao reports, Angry Chinese tourists stage another noisy patriotic protest after fog forces cruise ship to stay in port. A group of Chinese tourists who were angry that their cruise ship had been delayed by bad weather staged a protest with strong nationalist overtones by jostling staff while loudly singing China's national anthem. The incident is the latest in a series of cases where Chinese tourists have resorted to shows of patriotism when inconvenienced. A report published on Sina.com described how the mainly middle-aged passengers angrily jostled crew members while singing the country's national anthem, the March of the Volunteers. Norwegian Cruise Line canceled the sailing for the Norwegian Joy vessel because of fog. The cruise line said customers would be reimbursed by their travel agencies or insurers. China's national anthem law says that those who distort or disrespect the anthem in public could face 3 years in jail. And in the Japan Times, Takanahana handed fifth demotion as sumo world faces string of scandals. Sumo elder Takanahana, who has been faulted for his absence from the most recent spring grand sumo tournament and the failure to supervise a wrestler from his stable, was handed a two-rank demotion by the Japan Sumo Association. Sumo is struggling to rebuild its tarnished image with the scandal that led to the retirement of Hiruma Fuji in December, causing Emperor Akihito and Empress Michiko to skip their New Year tournament visit. Before and after the incident surrounding Hiruma Fuji, in which he injured Takanuya, a junior wrestler, in an alcohol-fueled attack during a regional tour last fall, the world of sumo wrestling saw a string of scandals that severely damaged its reputation. In January, sumo's chief referee resigned for sexually harassing a teenage referee, and earlier this month, Egyptian wrestler Asuna Rashi was asked to retire as punishment for being involved in a car accident while driving without a license. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In the Spokane Spokesman Review, John Blanchett reports, "Walking His Darkest Path, Mark Rippins, Long Struggle with Traumatic Brain Injury." From his days as a record-shattering high school quarterback at Shadle Park to the pinnacle as a Super Bowl MVP, Mark Rippin has lived and sometimes made a living on his memories. In interviews this week, he shared details of his struggles with mental illness, suicidal thoughts, and emotional control. He's been prompted, he said, by a dark winter in his community. He took note of the January suicide of Washington State University quarterback Tyler Hilinski, and the more recent news of Coeur d'Alene High School principal Troy Schuler dying from an apparent self-inflicted gunshot. He learned from his brother, Tim, a teacher at North Central, of an epidemic of suicides among students and across Spokane's teenage population. "Silence is the killer," Rippin said. "It's time to talk about mental health." In the middle of Rippin's deepest struggles, things got worse. His cousin, Rick Rippin, a National Hockey League veteran with the Vancouver Canucks, who had struggled with clinical depression throughout his career, took his life in 2011. Shaken by it then, Rippin cites it now as a part of his resolve not to become another statistic. "He has become just as soured about the game which provided him some wonderful, wonderful things. Today," Rippin said, "I wouldn't put any of my kids or grandkids in a football jersey and play this sport." In Kamloops this week, Sean Brady reports, "Upper Nicola Indian Band hopes sun shines on solar project." The Upper Nicola Indian Band will go to referendum on whether to sign over 200 acres for the development of a solar farm. In partnership with Fortis, the development arm of Upper Nicola is looking to build a 15-megawatt solar farm that would provide enough electricity to power 5,000 homes. The band's 480 eligible voters will cast ballots on April 16th. The project is expected to cost between $30 million and $40 million and include 56,000 solar modules. Construction would start in March 2019, and the project would be connected to the grid in October 2019. It would be the largest solar installation in the province, dwarfing the 1-megawatt project built on the site of the former Sullivan Mine in Kimberley. And in the Everett Herald, Noah Hagland reports, "Some in Snohomish wonder, can local politics be less toxic?" A new civic group has set out to reform the ugly politics that took over this place of charming streetscapes. The activists call themselves the Snohomish Building Bridges Social Club. They want to change a climate left by rancorous city council meetings and contentious elections in this historic city on the Snohomish River. To make it happen, they plan to use goodwill and reliable information. Individual bridge builders are politically active and some are in elected office. But when they meet as a group, there are two rules. We don't talk politics and we don't discuss things on social media. Instead, they meet face to face. For two straight years, contentious elections split the city's voters in half, pitting an insistent band of reformers against a cadre of civic leaders who said shaking up the status quo would leave the city worse off. In 2016, voters narrowly supported an initiative to convert the city to a strong mayor form of government. It passed by just 9 votes. That's Cascadia calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for the Big Deal feature. Mr. EB goes to Ottawa. Mr. Wiley goes to Westminster. From money laundering at casinos to Facebook data mining, Victoria's secrets are revealed. On Tuesday, March 27th, in two world capitals, two British Columbians appeared before parliamentary committees. NDP Attorney General David Eby was in Ottawa to urge the House of Commons Finance Committee to crack down on money laundering, after his predecessors in the BC government turned a blind eye for years. British Columbia's casinos and real estate market are rife with money laundering, fueled by billions of Chinese renminbi.
The regulator walked me through extensive and overwhelming evidence of large-scale money laundering in British Columbia Lower Mainland casinos. I was shown video and photographs of individuals wheeling large suitcases packed with $20 bills, others bringing stacks of cash to casino cages. I was astounded by the audacity of those involved. On a purely practical matter, $800,000 in 20s is very heavy. It looked like they were helping somebody move a box of books. But I was equally astounded that this activity had been taking place in British Columbia without an effective criminal, legal, regulatory, or policy response for almost a decade. There have been, to my knowledge, no related criminal charges or tax prosecutions to date related to the activity that I witnessed. Suspicious cash transactions began climbing at BC casinos in 2009, following the defunding of BC's provincial integrated casino policing team. Large, suspicious cash transactions continued unabated from 2009 until late 2017. When our new government instructed BC casinos that they should no longer accept large cash transactions where they didn't know where the cash was coming from. And we're still not done yet in terms of solving this problem. I retained anti-money laundering expert Dr. Peter German, a former senior RCMP officer, the author of Canada's leading textbook on anti-money laundering law, who has been investigating and reviewing what has happened in British Columbia and will advise me in a report that I will receive at the end of this month about how the province at the provincial level can address this problem. At the federal level, I would really like for this committee to understand the colossal nature of the regulatory failure that took place and frankly may still be taking place in British Columbia. The issue in British Columbia is so notorious and so severe that I was briefed on an international intelligence community training session in which international intelligence members were taught about something called the Vancouver model of money laundering. We are famous internationally, or more accurately, we become infamous for money laundering. In the Vancouver model of money laundering, a wealthy individual from China, a country with strict currency export controls, wants to gamble. A gangster will meet that gambler at a casino, offering cash in amounts as high as hundreds of thousands of dollars. In one transaction, $1.2 million in cash. The cash is the proceeds of gang crime. To pay for the cash, the gambler agrees to transfer money in China from his bank account into a bank account under the control of the gang. The gambler walks the illicit cash into the casino, completes a FinTrack reporting form, buys chips, gambles, and on leaving either cashes out, receiving a check, or carries the chips out of the casino. In sum, the criminal gang has successfully laundered difficult-to-manage $20 bills, moving the money out of Canada while keeping their names off of FinTrack forms. Those involved in the transaction can truthfully report that everyone is following all of the reporting rules. FinTrack will aggressively audit and confirm that the reports have been made accurately. The only real evidence of a problem is a guy lugging a hockey bag full of $20 bills into the casino. And you might think that that alone would be enough to start a police investigation or a Revenue Canada investigation. It has not been. BC's casino policing team was funded again and resurrected with a better mandate in 2016 and is now unsurprisingly but thankfully involved in a massive transnational criminal investigation. Now, I'd like to thank those who work at FinTrack. I believe they collect critically important information and ensure it is accurate. The issue is not their fault, but there is a problem. An anti-money laundering system that rigorously enforces compliance with reporting but does not have an enforcement arm puts a sheep mask on a wolf's face.
Data scientist and whistleblower Christopher Wiley urged the United Kingdom's Media Committee to investigate the role that Victoria's aggregate IQ played in the Cambridge Analytica and Facebook scandal. The small data and web advertising company had a role in elections in Nigeria, Trinidad and Tobago, the United States, and the UK. Wiley played a role in helping aggregate IQ form and has gone public after helping give birth to psychological warfare via social media. Aggregate IQ worked with the BC Green Party in 2016, in 2018 with Todd Stone's failed BC Liberal leadership campaign. The company is under investigation by information and privacy authorities in BC and the UK. Wiley, with pink hair and big reading glasses, spoke to the Digital, Culture, Media and Sport Committee about aggregate IQ and its questionable tactics.
One of the things that I've also passed on to the committee is some of the contractual documentation and emails from some of AIQ's past projects. One of them was for the Minister of National Security of Trinidad. In the contractual documents and then also email chains, AIQ, part of the project was to go out and find a way of accessing raw internet service provider data for the entire country to monitor what people were browsing in that country. As I understand it, that's not legal in Trinidad. It certainly wouldn't be legal here. But the thing that I would say is that aggregate IQ, in part because it was set up and works within the auspices of Cambridge Analytica, inherited a lot of the company culture of total disregard for the law. And so I would, again, strongly encourage actually looking at, you know, this question of where did they get the data? You know, when I met with Don Cummings in November 2015, one of the things that was apparent is that Vote Leave at the time actually didn't have any data. So to go, that's in November 2015. So, and Don Cummings, in part, wanted to meet with me because he was really interested in Cambridge Analytica. He also said that he wanted to create the quote-unquote Palantir for politics. And, you know, but it became apparent that it's like, well, if you don't even have the electoral register, let alone, you know, a social database, you can't really do this, or you can't really do this legally. You know, very shortly after that meeting, they then engage AIQ. I think in part, although this bit is me speculating, I think in part because they couldn't, it would look odd if Leave EU was working with Cambridge Analytica and Vote Leave was working with Cambridge Analytica, but you could get the next best thing, which is a company that can do virtually everything that CA can do, but with a different you know, billing name for your invoices. But my question is, where did you get the data? Because how do you create a massive targeting operation in a country that AIQ hadn't previously worked in 2 months? It baffles me as to how that could happen in such a short amount of time. So that's a good question. It's unfortunate that AIQ hides behind jurisdictional barriers and doesn't actually come here and answer those questions. But it is something that hopefully can be looked at. So how did it actually work? You know, this is a company that has worked with hacked material, right? This is a company that will send out videos of people being murdered to intimidate voters. This is a company that goes out and tries to illicitly acquire, you know, live internet browsing data of everyone in an entire country. So I think a lot of questions should be asked about the role of Aggregate IQ in this election and whether they were indeed actually compliant with the law here.
Every week, we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to a deserving person or organization that has made a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to Sorrel Sademan and the Rabbitats Rescue Society. It's Easter, and while you're enjoying chocolate eggs, think of this group. This group spends the whole year trying to rescue and house abandoned and feral rabbits. Look them up online. Their website is Rabbitats, RABBITATS.org. Nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send us an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Be like listener Joe Kunzler, who nominates Chris Sims of the Canadian Taxpayers Federation for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Joe appreciates Chris Sims for taking names and kicking ass for taxpayers. In an email, Joe said that with the BC Liberals selling their soul to the elites, it's now Chris Sims who's watching out for taxpayers. I mean, Andrew Wilkinson doesn't support a TransLink referendum, and I doubt the fickle green MLAs do either. Furthermore, what the hell do the BC Libs want to do about the ICBC dumpster fire they started? At least Chris Sims has a plan. Thank you to Joe Kunzler. Well, that's it for the Breaker.News podcast for April 1st, 2018. Did you know, on April 1st, 1976, Apple Computer formed? And on April 1st, 2004, Google launched its free Gmail service. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas. The email address is bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.